Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, ASU's football team is getting ready to play what might be its most important game in decades. And it turns out we don't know as much as we thought about tumbleweed. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We anticipate that there will be those who oppose the will of the voters and still would like to restrict people's ability to access abortion care, but we're prepared to meet them, whoever they may be.
For those of us that are trying to hold up the judicial system, hold up the professionals in the Department of Justice, support the rule of law, certainly this makes it harder for us to make that case.
The water issue and the public lands issue and the tribe issue, those are big in the Southwest. We need to protect those issues and the gains that we've made there.
We are not infringing on one's constitutional rights by not having an online request form available. And so we closed that because we were running into concerns about the timeliness of being able to respond to these requests.
You have groups of people, numerous people, that might read something in the paper and file a bar complaint. Our ethics rules and complaint procedure rules are really not written for that.
And joining me to talk about some early bills for next year's legislative session, a senior congressional Democrat stepping down from a leadership position and more, are Doug Cole of High Ground. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Mark.
And former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman. Aaron, good morning, too.
Great to be here.
So, guys, a few early bills pre-filed. Tis the season for lawmakers to get a head start on pre-filing bills. A couple of them are going to sound fairly familiar to people who have followed the legislative process over the past few years. Doug, let me start with you on an election-related bill. It seems as though one of the things that Democrats and Republicans agree on in terms of potential changes to election administration is they would love the results to be done earlier. And they tend to agree that one of the reasons that doesn't happen is because people drop off their ballots too close to Election Day. They need to have their signatures verified, and that kind of slows down the process a little bit. There's a pre-filed bill that would basically end late early ballots unless voters provide a signature verification. Is this a solution that you think Democrats and Republicans can agree on?
Well, I think that bill, and for our listeners, that Senate Bill 1001, it was pre-filed last Friday, which was when you first can pre-file bills. It's the same. It's a very similar bill to a bill that Senator J.D. Mesnard introduced last year. But I do think in this cycle, probably is going to have a little bit more momentum behind it. What it says is early ballots must be turned in by Friday, and if you do come with an early ballot, then it goes through a signature verification process at the polling place, and then that there would be a non-verified box, and there would be a verified box at each polling place, and then that would speed up and give them the opportunity to run it through the on-site tabulation machines, mm-hmm. if they have them, which we do in Maricopa County, but they don't have them in Pinal County. So it, you know, it had different applications across the state. I do think it's going to be a hotly debated topic. Florida has that Friday cutoff, but we've also seen the governor and other Democrats saying we will not support that effort. So it has a potential to be vetoed by the governor.
But
it was last year. So then it may be referred by the Republican majority to the 2026 ballot. Interestingly enough, though, besides J.D. Mesnard and Senate President Warren Peterson supporting this effort, this continued effort, Maricopa County incoming chairman Tom Galvin from District 2, he has also said he supports the Friday cutoff. Mm-hmm. He also supports getting rid of emergency voting, which is the voting on Saturday and the Monday before, and also requiring more governmental buildings to be used as polling centers here in Maricopa County. So it's going to be front and center right off the bat in the legislature, and it's probably going to be the
quote, election-related reform that will probably have the most steam initially.
Do you think it'll have steam among Democrats, Aaron?
It'll be interesting to see. It's tough when you've gone on record and vetoed something. It's, you know, you're in the John Kerry world of I was for it before I was against it, which is, you know, probably one of the worst political quotes of all time. So it's hard to get people to do a 180 on that. My bigger question is like, well, what's the problem you're trying to solve for? I personally liked it when our politicians were trying to make it easy for as many people to vote as possible. Again, I mean, it's kind of sad. In my view, one of the few good parts about Trump winning is we don't have to hear about the fictitious big lie. But that's what this all goes back to. We never had a problem with our votes. We've never had a problem with voter fraud in Arizona. And we're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. On some level, this specific issue gets down to what's your priority? More people being able to vote, because some people will not be able to vote if this goes through. More people, legal voters being able to vote or finding out the results faster. I kind of come down in the middle of that. It's nice to know. I've waited in my own election for, you know, 7-8 days. It wasn't the end of the world. It's kind of discomfort for a small number of politicians to find out who wins. Nothing really changes in the outcome and you have more people vote. That's where I come down.
Yeah, I want to put it in context. Because of the new state law, we know exactly, and we knew election night, how many late earlies there were. And statewide, there were exactly 265,000 late earlies. A little over 200,000 of those were in Maricopa County. Mm-hmm. So When you're – this never was a problem in the past before Arizona became a swing state.
But when the elections weren't close, it didn't matter.
The elections weren't as close. And now, you know, for the last decade, they've been getting closer. So now it is it's a perceived problem. And so if you want elections faster, well, there's give and take on both sides of the equation.
I mean, we're not California, right, which just finished counting in its last congressional race this week.
Yeah, I think you won by 1,500 votes or something like that. Look, we are really close. It just gets down to do you value more people voting or speed of finding out the result? You know, I always err on the side of let's let people vote.
Right, and that California race was significant because the Republicans now it's 220 to 215.
215, I think.
Yeah.
So, Aaron, speaking of potential momentum among Democrats, a couple of bills that seem like maybe they won't have that this year as they did not last year. Some of the quote-unquote culture war bills, the pronoun bill, a so-called bathroom bill coming back again. This time, though, the sponsor is talking about, like, if he can't get them through the legislature and signed by the governor, maybe he'll just take them to the voters and think, you know, based on the results of this year's election, he might have a decent shot. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah. I mean, it was very interesting. I talked to a lot of people who were like, if it said referred by the Arizona legislature, I'm opposed to it. Just went straight down the line.
This past year,
there were so many. Now, obviously, there was one notable exception to that where there was a lot of public support for that border bill that did get passed. So people did read, they did pick one out of the crowd, they did vote for it. You know, this is a really tough issue. I think everybody feels for, you know, some of the kids involved and all those other things. It affects a very small number of people and has somehow become a hill that is really seeming to cost Democrats in election time. And so, my personal experiences, did Christine Marsh, my good friend, I'm heartbroken that she lost. Did she lose because of her lack of support for this bill last time? I don't think so. She lost because she was caught up in a red wave. And there's not a lot of attention to nuance in these races for state house. I think people are going to vote kind of like they did last time, and the governor's going to veto it when it gets to her desk.
Well, and I think they feel a little more emboldened, too, because you ask any political consultant or professor of our trade that probably the most effective ad in the presidential race was that the Trump ad mm-hmm. against Kamala Harris on this issue that they played over and over and over.
Was that she cares for about they, them, not
that,
us?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That ad, I think, was the number one ad in all the polls show and all the focus groups shows that moved the most people. So I think we're not only here in Arizona, we're going to see it across the country because of the – whether it's true or not, how successful that ad was against Kamala Harris.
Does that move the needle legislatively? And to your point about Governor Hobbs, does that change anything with her, assuming this bill makes it through a Republican-controlled legislature?
Yeah. You know, it'd be very interesting if you had some swing district folks down there, the ones that are left, switch their vote on this. Again, for the governor, it's a lose-lose, right? You know, either you deal with the fact you totally flip-flopped on this issue to try to take it away. Guess what the ad says? 1 year earlier, she voted for it. You still have that. You know what I mean? Or you seem like you're taking a principled position that may be out of step with the majority of Arizona voters. It's a tough situation. I you know, personally had a very strict, like, I don't change my mind if I've thought about an issue and really thought about it. It's going to take a lot after a vote to do that. I suspect the governor will veto it again.
Are both of you expecting to see more bills either pre-filed or filed once the session starts this year that are duplicates of what we've seen in recent years? Doug, what do you think?
Absolutely. You know, November 6th, her reelection campaign started. And as you've talked about on this show, you know, the Senate's now 17-13 and the House is 33-27, which are gains in both chambers. So I think we're going to see more of the same. You know, she vetoed 140 some bills her first session. She vetoed 70 something bills.
Fewer for sure in the second.
Fewer.
Yeah.
We could be back more of the 2023 session. Because, you know, it's all going to be about 2026 now. You know, the political cycles never end, do they?
Well, the one thing I'll say is that cuts both ways. You know, my legislative district, which, you know, LD4 will now be all Republicans for our Arts in Paradise Valley. It'll be the first time in over a decade that we've had only Republicans, you know, representing us. But those guys are on the ballot. And are they going to vote for all this? You know, my view, a lot of this extreme stuff that will get served up. Guess what? It's going to be the mailers and the, I don't know how we got into attack 4x4 signs in Arizona over the last two cycles, but they seem to be everywhere. Like, that's going to be Serene Warner and that's going to be Matt Gress's name on that stuff if they sign off on some of this stuff. So it'll be interesting to see how the moderates or the swing district Republicans are able to tamp some of that down.
Correct.
Does it affect the governor, though? Like, isn't it an effective attack ad for somebody to say she vetoed a transgender-related bill twice or three times as opposed to once? Like, does it matter how many times she vetoes the same bill?
No, it just keeps it current. Remember, political cycles, voters' memories are generally short. So you want to keep it rolling. So even though it was in 2023 or 2024, you need to do it in 2025 and 2026 to keep it, you know, on social media, in the headlines, and fresh.
I think people get so caught up on these individual issue things. It's really rare that there's enough money to communicate about it, that it moves the needle, that it reaches enough people. Usually there are much larger dynamics that kind of play out in elections. Another silver lining for Governor Hobbs is going to be there's usually a bounce back after the presidency switches. It's happened the last four or five cycles on Congress. I think it could
happen.
In the midterms. Yeah. You know what I mean? That, look, the party that wins is complacent and feels like they kind of got everything. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Donald Trump's going to do a few things that will antagonize many Democrats and independents in the next 2 years. And then they get out and motivated. That's honestly what got me elected in 2018 after Trump got elected in 2016. So I suspect it'll actually be a much better cycle for Dems when a lot of ours stay home feeling like, hey, we've won, we got it all. And there's a lot of fodder to motivate Dems and you know, some of the independents to get out and vote.
Yeah, historically, Aaron is very correct in modern American political history. And you also remember it's a non-presidential year.
Exactly.
Our gubernatorial cycles here in Arizona, and the voter turnout's different. So a lot of these voters that are only vote every, you know, three elections or every four elections, they just voted and they won't show up in 2020.
Right. Interesting. All right. That is Doug Cole. I'm also joined by Aaron Lieberman. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former state lawmaker Aaron Lieberman and Doug Cole of High Ground. Doug, let me ask you about a lawsuit filed this week over the state's 15-week abortion ban. This was not unexpected because the law is still on the books despite the constitutional amendment that was approved by voters in November. Are you expecting a quick resolution to this and potentially other lawsuits related to this, I hate to use this phrase, but sort of like clean up the abortion law, some of which are now competing in Arizona?
That's correct. You know, this was a constitutional amendment. So we have a lot of statutes dealing with the abortion issue. So we'll see more as it goes along, because statutes need to conform with the Constitution. There's many statutes now that don't conform with the Constitution. And absent the legislature coming in, don't hold your breath. coming in and cleaning and conforming state statute to the new constitutional requirements, the only venue is to go through the courts. So the process has now started after the canvas, because that's when, once the canvas is signed, that's when the new constitutional amendment from Prop 139 takes effect. So this is going to be an ongoing process, and we're going to continue to see probably the Center for Arizona, for the CAP group, Kathy Herridge group, Center for Arizona Policy, and others, you know, fighting these court cases to roll back statute that they have carefully put in for the last 20 years.
Stipulating that none of us in this room are lawyers,
yeah.
Do you think any of the current laws survive?
I'm just trying to figure out what the justification those Supreme Court justices could possibly use for this, having watched so many decisions that I felt were quite tortured in terms of coming up with what was clearly a political motivation to get to an end that they wanted. I don't know how you could possibly do it. When you had the vote that you had all the people out there for it. This was definitely expected. I personally am very glad that this has just been resolved and protected in the Constitution, frankly, to get it away from the politicians. And it's sad to say this, but even some of the judges that were appointed by politicians who seemed more focused on a political point of view becoming a reality in Arizona than interpreting the Constitution of Arizona and saying, you know, I love the John Roberts line. We're calling balls and strikes. That's their role is what does the Constitution say? It's very, very clear. The important thing for me for people to realize on this is that when that abortion ban passed at 15 weeks, it was the most restrictive in the United States. Straight party line vote signed by Governor Ducey.
With no exceptions.
With no exceptions. Yes. Somehow when the territorial ban came in part, it seemed like, oh, this was a very moderate position and there were signs up. Abortion's legal in Arizona to 15 weeks. You know what I mean? That was and is an extreme position. And I think we've gotten to a much more reasonable framework with the constitutional amendment that was passed.
All right. Aaron, let me stick with you and move to Washington, D.C., where Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva won re-election last month, but says this is his last term. He's had some health issues. He's been battling cancer. He has for a long time been either the chairman or the ranking member, basically the highest ranking Democrat when they're in the minority on the Natural Resources Committee, which is a pretty important position for folks in Arizona. He was facing a challenge to that position from another from a California Democrat. And he said, OK, I'm going to step down from this, but then decided not to endorse that Democrat for his old spot.
Yeah. Politics are interesting, isn't it? Only in the U.S. Congress is the 60-year-old, the up-and-comer, you know, upstart who's, you know, trying to make waves. There's a real changing of the guard clearly happening. I think Jerry Nadler in New York also did it. It was involved in a similar thing.
Yeah, with Jamie Raskin.
Exactly. Like, you know, a passing of the torch. I suspect some of it is exhaustion. Some of it is, and I can speak to personal experience, it's a lot less fun to be in the minority than in the majority in terms of what you get to do. And then some personal stuff for Congressman Grijalva in terms of what he's dealing with as well.
But let's look at what a loss this is for the state of Arizona. The House Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, what it used to be called, is called now the House Resources Committee, for decades was chaired by Arizona's own Morris K. Udall. On that committee with him were John McCain, John Rhodes, Jay Rhodes, John Kyle, Eldon Rudd. You can go back forever. Arizona usually has one, two, or even three congressmen on that committee because it is fundamental to this state. It's water, national parks, tribal issues. You know, it really touches Arizona. So it's a big loss. I mean, here we're losing a major, you know, political figure in Washington is stepping aside. You know, we used to have, you know, John McCain as chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Bob Stump, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, chairman of the Veterans, you know, Committee, majority leader, Ernest McFarland. I mean, you know, we have a very junior congressional delegation now that is so different from the past where Arizona really punched way above its weight.
Well, and to that point, Doug, I mean, Grijalva is the senior most, I believe, yes. Not just Democrat, but member of the Arizona congressional delegation. And while he is staying in Congress, he's only staying in Congress for one more term. So when he leaves, I think, Aaron, that just makes Arizona's delegation, to Doug's point, even maybe a little more junior.
Yeah, I think it was actually Mo Udall who used to say to incoming congressman about the seniority system, the longer you're here, the more you'll like it. And, you know,
I think you're correct.
It just kind of gets to it's a little bit of a cycle of life. Some of that is because, you know, we have new senators and, you know, give them some time. It does seem to me, and who knows, it'll be very interesting to see that one thing that's happened with our politics is the 30, 40 years. I mean, how long was McCain between the House and the Senate? You know, that doesn't
He started his first term in 1983 in the
House. So, I mean, do the math, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Literally and passed away in the seat.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't seem to happen as much anymore. Yeah. And the flip side of that is there will be more movement on this stuff. I was just smiling as Doug was talking because I bet 90% of the listeners maybe picked out Mo Udall and John McCain's name from that. Now everyone else, you know, history moves on. It's what's going on today. And these people had such a huge impact, by the way, including Representative Grijalva. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act was, it is absolutely one of the most transformative pieces of legislature to
and
try
And his committee
to,
was at, involved at, in it, that.
Completely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, huge, enormous contribution. And you really see that. There tend to be these small windows where there's a big thing that happens. And he got to put his, you know, handprints all over that, which is pretty amazing.
All right, guys, just a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you again, stipulating that none of us in this room are lawyers. There's a
Thank
lawsuit.
Goodness.
Yeah. I'll leave that there. There's a lawsuit this week challenging the Maricopa County transportation sales tax, saying that because it did not get 60% of the vote, that it did not pass because there's a new rule that says that 60% of the voters have to approve tax increases. Aaron, do you see this as worrisome if you're Maricopa County?
I think they were very careful in how it was referred and saying it was not. The lawyers were involved in trying to figure out how to dot the I's and cross the T's. By the way, didn't it get like 59.8%?
It was very close.
59.82, I think something around there.
And so at a minimum, can't we just round up and call it a day and say it got 60? But again, I just get back to who are the leaders of the Maricopa County Republican Party that have 60% of their constituents voting for something. It's one of the best things that has ever happened to Maricopa County. And just look at, like, we would be Tucson if we hadn't had that sales tax and been doing all these highways and all this other stuff. And, you know, it's broadly supported by everybody, and you're filing a lawsuit against it. It's like, you know, let's just move on and get to trying to make where we live a better place.
I just like to point out that we are on the air in Tucson, so if you're angry with that comment, direct your comments to Aaron.
Well, by the way, it's correct.
Because I'm from
it's
Southern
strength.
Arizona, and I disavow that comment.
On some level, it's a strength. It is kind of – you feel like you've gone back 50 years.
This was Prop 132 from, I think, 2 years ago, and it requires 60% of it on a voter pass initiative if it raises taxes. So there's a lot of attacks how to fight this thing. One, I think the legislative record's pretty clear that this was meant for constitutional issues, which this is not. Mm-hmm. It is a county, only a countywide, and it doesn't. It's for statewide issues only. This is only a Maricopa County issue. So they're gonna. That's how it's going to be litigated. You know, the county has great lawyers, Tom Liddy, and his team down there in the civil division. So it'll be litigated, and I anticipate that this challenge will be thrown out. Again, lawyer behind it is Brian Blem who was sanctioned by the Supreme Court back in this past June and lost his law license for 60 days. He's on probation right now.
Well, to me, it just goes back to the original sin. If I'm not mistaken, I think Ducey vetoed this on his way out the door. You know what I mean? Which could have put this all to bed, and we wouldn't have had to waste any of this time. Let's put people before politics.
All right. That is Aaron Lieberman, Doug Cole. Thanks, you guys, both for coming in. Really appreciate the conversation.
Take care.
Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what the ASU football team did to defy expectations this season. But first, the plant species Salsola tragus is better known by its colloquial name, tumbleweed. Tumbleweed first appeared in South Dakota in 1874. It was brought to the U.S. in flaxseed from Russia, which is why scientists also call it Russian thistle. It's considered an invasive species. The prickly, brambly orbs roll at random across the open spaces, throwing off seeds as they go, which results in more and more tumbleweed. It's become a staple in Western movies, a symbol of the boom and bust cycle of life on the American frontier. And for more than a century, we thought we knew just about everything there was to know about it. But then, in the mid-1990s, scientists Deborah Ayers and Fred Ryan began gathering tumbleweed samples here in Arizona and in California's Central Valley. As Ayers recently told the show's Sam Dingman, when they started testing the samples, they realized they weren't just looking at Russian thistle.
We discovered that 40% of the plants that we sampled throughout the Central Valley in California were something completely different.
Huh.
This unknown tumbleweed that we hadn't identified anywhere in the world.
Huh.
And it turned out it was this Australian tumbleweed. So somehow the Australian tumbleweed got into California and into Arizona. And we're not sure which came first, because this species was never identified until Dr. Ryan and I did it through molecular biology.
Interesting. And so if I'm hearing you right, this Australian version of tumbleweed was sort of hiding in plain sight for decades.
Absolutely. And even now, I think that people look at tumbleweed and they say, oh, that's just tumbleweed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, big deal. It's a big widespread weed. It occurs in all 48 lower states. And who cares to map it? But it turns out it's kind of fascinating.
Yes.
When you do map it.
Well, so before we get to some of the other fascinating elements of it, tell us why tumbleweed tumbles. Where does the name come from?
Well, this is actually a fascinating dispersal mechanism in Russian thistle, but maybe not so much in the Australian thistle. The bottom of the plant, the stem part where it meets the roots, it breaks off naturally. And when it breaks off, the plant is round. It's like a ball. The wind picks it up and blows it until it stops by a fence or a tree or a house. There are some amazing pictures on the web where the tumbleweeds are as high as the roof line and perhaps 20 deep on houses where the wind has blown.
Oh my God.
The plants, and they've fetched up against these houses. And then if the plants happen to catch on fire, there's a big trouble, because the plants, when they blow, are very dry. They're very flammable, and they can skip and blow into other tumbleweeds and start fires. So it's a matter of some concern that there are these abundant tumbleweed populations.
And there is also now a third type of tumbleweed,
yes.
Correct?
So-called monster tumbleweed. Well, what happened was Dr. Fred Ryan, he was in Coalinga, and he noticed a tumbleweed that didn't look like either of the tumbleweeds we were familiar with, because mm-hmm. we had identified both this mystery tumbleweed and then Russian tumbleweed. And this was different than either one of them. And so we did molecular biology and chromosome counts and all kinds of investigations on this mystery tumbleweed. And it turned out that the Australian and the Russian tumbleweed hybridized. This new plant is a brand new species, which was named after Fred Ryan, Salsola ryanii, or Ryan's tumbleweed, and it's spreading. And this new tumbleweed, Ryan's tumbleweed, is going to be more invasive than either of its parental species.
And why is that? Is that because it's like larger, and so it has more flowers and therefore produces more seeds, or?
Exactly. The plant spreads, of course, by tumbling, and it latches onto cars, and it latches onto railroad cars. But when the two species come together, both the Russian and Ryan's tumbleweed can probably get almost as tall as a person. They're generally under 6 feet tall.
Uh-huh.
And if they're globular, if they're like a ball, they're going to be 6 feet in diameter. So that can be a substantial plant.
Yeah.
And when it blows into the roadways, they break off and they blow into the roadways. It can be quite a challenge to, you know, drive up the Central Valley of California with these 6 foot diameter plants tumbling in front of you.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about the iconography of the tumbleweed, because the tumbleweed is, I think, in the popular imagination, very much associated with the idea of the Old West, kind of blowing through small towns. We've seen it a lot in Westerns. But if I'm not mistaken, that is an anachronistic image.
If we think that our Westerns occurred, you know, post-Civil War, sometime in the 1870s or something, tumbleweed wasn't here. Tumbleweeds just happened to tumble into Westerns that were made, you know, in the 1940s or 50s or something. So
uh-huh.
they weren't there. They weren't there in the 1870s. No.
Why do you think, and, you know, I realize I'd just be asking you to speculate here, but why do you think they became such an appealing image for filmmakers who were trying to tell the story of the Old West?
That is such a great question. It could be that just happenstance. They're filming one of these, you know, dirt roads in the town, and all of a sudden there's tumbleweeds tumbling in, and what are we going to do about these weeds tumbling in? And they said, let's make it part of the movie. Yeah. I don't know. Why not?
Right. Necessity is the mother of invention and all that.
Exactly.
I have to say, it is, you know, it's interesting to me. I was talking with our producer Sativa about this, and we're just kind of remarking on the fact that, you know, whether those filmmakers would have intended this or not, there is something quite metaphorical about the tumbleweed in terms of the nature of a lot of those stories, because it's this rootless, amorphous thing that is kind of carried west, spreading its seeds everywhere sort of willy-nilly without regard for the damage that it might be doing. I mean, there is a sort of a manifest destiny, misguided American dream connection there if you want to find it.
Probably not the only misguided manifest destiny in this country, but yeah.
Is it correct to say that tumbleweeds are also, in a way, something of a harbinger of the effects of climate change?
Not yet, mm-hmm. No. But the interesting question is, what will they do as climates become drier? Because they're very drought tolerant. If the moisture isn't there, how well do they survive? If they're able to access moisture that other plants can't because of the depth of their roots, I wouldn't bet against them. You know, when they started spreading out of South Dakota, an agricultural commissioner somewhere along the line, he said, kill it now. If it appears in your landscape, kill it all. And this was, you know, many, I don't know, 100 years ago, maybe, kill it all. But that advice was not followed, of course.
Right. And here we are dealing with the monster tumbleweed.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Dr. Deborah Ayers is a retired scientist at UC Davis. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. ASU's football team will take on Iowa State tomorrow in Texas in the Big 12 championship game. This is, of course, ASU's first season in that conference, and to put it mildly, expectations were not high for how they do. Now, if ASU wins tomorrow, they'll move on to the college football playoff with a chance to play for a national championship. With me to talk about this is Chris Cartman, publisher of Sun Devil Source for 24/7 Sports. And Chris, just how big of a surprise is it that ASU is playing for the Big 12 championship and a spot in the college football playoff?
It's a huge surprise, especially when measured against preseason expectations. ASU was 16th in the preseason Big 12 media poll. This is the biggest year-over-year improvement in ASU football history in the win column. And also, this team has achieved the most one-score wins, 8 or fewer points, with 6 in history, dating to 1897. That could never have been expected. The conventional wisdom is, of course, that teams need to learn how to win. ASU was 3-9 last season and had a redshirt freshman quarterback starting for the first time and somehow bucked the odds to end up in this pretty impressive situation.
So how did they do it then? What went right for them this year?
Well, Kenny Dillingham, their coach who just won Big 12 Coach of the Year, preached the importance of turnover margin throughout the offseason from spring ball into preseason camp. And ASU ended up tied for first in the Big 12 in that category. The top four teams in the conference are the top four teams in turnover margin. So when you have a redshirt freshman quarterback, especially in Sam Levitt, who only threw 5 interceptions, which were the fewest among any regular starting quarterback in the conference, that was a huge start for them. And then Of course, Cam Scadaboo, their senior star running back, one of the better players at the position in the country, had a fantastic season, rushing behind one of the most improved offensive lines in the country. And Jordan Tyson, a superstar wide receiver, made it a little bit easier for Sam Levitt and that ASU offense to make these types of gains. And then defensively, just a very strong, deep, solid team that rallies to the football, doesn't really give up a lot of big plays, no cheap ones over the top. These guys have focused on being process-oriented and as opposed to results-oriented, and they bought into Dillingham's mantra of having more fun working harder than any time in their lives.
So you mentioned someone like Cam Scadaboo, a senior running back. I'm curious how this year sets up this program for the immediate future.
Well, 2/3 of their starters have remaining eligibility, including some of their best players. They're going to have to replace Cam Scadaboo. I think there's a really good chance that they appeal to a lot of the higher profile running backs that end up in the transfer portal. And then I think also they should have in Sam Levitt and Jordan Tyson, one of the best quarterback wide receiver duos in the country next year, because both of those guys are underclassmen. That's a remarkable thing that you can build around. They're going to have some key players to replace, not just Scadaboo, but also Leif Al-Tanu, their all-conference center, and Shamari Simmons, who's one of their best defensive players, and a few other guys. But I think that they are extremely well-positioned and should be one of the top teams in the preseason poll next year for the Big 12.
So you mentioned head coach Kenny Dillingham, and one of the things that he has really prioritized and talked a lot about is the importance of NIL, name, image, and likeness. And it's something that he seems to take pretty seriously. How significant has that been so far in terms of recruiting players and keeping players, and how might that play a role going forward? You talk about trying to replace some of the players who will be exhausting their eligibility after this season.
That's one of the most impressive aspects of what they've accomplished, because ASU's roster probably cost around $3 million, according to sources, in NIL this year, which is far less than most of the teams that are ranked in the top 15 of the CFP. Most of those teams are $10 million, up to $20 million or more in some cases. Ohio State's athletic director said that team's roster was around $20 million. I've heard Oregon is also in that range. The next year will be quite a lot different, though, because teams will be able to pay players directly following this House versus NCAA settlement. The exact amount is not super clear right now, but it's going to be probably somewhere north of $10 million for football teams to fill out their roster. And there will be some differences between lower level teams versus the blue blood programs. But NIL will not have an outsized impact, I would say, relative to what it currently exists. And that's a positive for teams like ASU that have financially not been able to compete at the top of the food chain. Although I still think that the best of the best programs are going to still acquire the most talent.
Sure. All right. So as we head into tomorrow's matchup, fill in the end of the following sentence. ASU's game against Iowa State in the Big 12 championship is this program's most important game since when?
2013, Arizona State hosted Stanford in the Pac-12 conference championship. So I would say that's the biggest game since then. But you could potentially, given the CFP ramifications, say that this is the biggest game since the 1996 Rose Bowl season, when ASU had a chance, if a couple other things fell right, including, I believe, Florida versus Florida State that year, coupled with had ASU beaten Ohio State, it could have been national champion. So we're talking about something that's happened at ASU once or twice over the last 30 years.
Yeah, I was thinking, doing the math really quickly, 30 years, that's quite a thing.
It's amazing. I've been covering ASU for 20 years, haven't missed a home game over that span. And this is by far the most impressive accomplishment, particularly when measured against expectations. Kenny Dillingham is the youngest head coach at the Power Four level, and he is one of the two most likely candidates for National Coach of the Year honors, along with Indiana's Kurt Cignetti, who had a miraculous turnaround from Indiana winning one game in the Big Ten last year to now being 11-1 in his first season. That's the only reason that Dillingham probably won't win National Coach of the Year.
Wow. All right. That is Chris Cartman, publisher of Sun Devil Source for 24/7 Sports. Chris, thanks again for the conversation and enjoy the game tomorrow.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Christmas music is one of those things that can inspire very strong feelings. From when we start listening each season to just what makes for the perfect holiday tune, there's a lot to debate. But for KJZZ contributor Robert Pala, there's simply no contest. Give him the oldies. We revisit an essay now with Pala from last holiday season.
I like Christmas. I like a real Christmas tree. I like a
I've tried listening to contemporary Christmas music. No, really. I've got the new Cher holiday album on repeat. I streamed Pentatonix's Christmas Is Here, and I made it halfway through Ariana Grande's Christmas record. But I'll be honest, when it comes to holiday music, I want a bag full of close harmonies and double-tracked countertenors and mezzo-sopranos singing scale-jumping fills. I want 60s pop superstars singing jingle bells. And I especially want old-school crooners. For me, it's not Christmas until I've played the Jack Jones Christmas album about 700 times. I mean, have you heard The Ventures' 1965 Christmas album? It's surf rock sleigh bells that this instrumental group gave a reverb-crazy twist. They grafted popular hits of the day onto Yuletide chestnuts. The record kicks off with a reference to The Ventures' biggest hit, Walk Don't Run, then slides into a kitschy riff on Sleigh Ride. Kitty favorites like Santa Claus Is Coming to Town and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer get groovy backbones from Woolly Bully and the Beatles' I Feel Fine, respectively. Even Frosty the Snowman isn't safe in a high holiday mashup with the Champs' Tequila. There are singers whose voices are built for the emotional pitch and campy mischief of holiday songs, and Lena Horne is among their number. In 1965's Mary from Lena, her five-piece combo puts real zip into some Christmas oldies. Her take on Frank Lesser's What Are You Doing New Year's Eve is rich and warm, and maybe second only to Edie Gourmet's version. Horn's jazzy riff on Jingle Bells, renamed Jingle All the Way, is a left-of-center blues hall rendition that's a real winner. She even convinced me to like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, whom she casts as a naughty young buck with a drinking problem. And then there are the really weird ones, like Christmas Bride, the all-time creepiest holiday tune ever committed to vinyl. From the Ray Conniff singer's Christmas with Conniff, this one's a sleepy earworm in which an obviously horny guy asks Santa Claus to bring him a wife for Christmas. Okay, it was 1959, but still, yikes.
Santa.
I thought I was tired of Silver Bells and sick to death of Winter Wonderland until I heard the Doris Day Christmas album. Doris does things with lesser-known beauties like Snowfall and Toyland and Ever the Class Act, skips the kiddie classics altogether. There are no Frosties or Santas here. And where did the song Christmas Present come from, and why haven't other singers covered it? Sidney Robbins' elegant ballad is the perfect showcase for Doris Day's lovely vibrato. The title song in Burt Kampfert's 1963 Christmas Wonderland album answers the musical question, what does an inebriated trumpet sound like? Kampfert's cocktail jazz, arranged around vibes and the orchestra leader's signature drunken horn solos, fits well with holiday fare. Santa Claus is Coming to Town is an upright bass-driven shuffle, and I Heard the Bells is a delightfully jangly brass band party. The maestro's original work, Holiday for Bells, is a joyful jump laced with Ima Sumac-like sirens wailing in the background. And the crazy, cheerful Toy Parade and Jingo Django sound like main title music for every Rankin Bass holiday special ever filmed. On Glen Campbell's 1968 That Christmas Feeling, Campbell makes new stuff like It Must Be Getting Close to Christmas and Christmas Is for Children sound like classics. He sells Roger Miller's Old Toy Trains as if it were his own. Covering Willie Nelson's Pretty Paper is a risk that pays off for Campbell in an Al DeLore arrangement that turns a schmaltzy waltz into a sonic masterpiece. My husband and I have a long-standing agreement that I will only listen to the Partridge Family Christmas Card after he leaves for work. And listen to it, I do. It's the only Partridge record on which Shirley Jones was allowed to sing leads. And as much as I like Mrs. Partridge's groovy version of the Christmas song, I really dig David Cassidy singing Frosty the Snowman as a funeral dirge. But not as much as I dig Jack Jones doing a Vegas loungy take on Mistletoe and Holly. His rendition of The Village of St. Bernadette is sublime. And Jack's Lullaby for Christmas Eve? Well, listen for yourself. And if you celebrate, have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Close your eyes, little doll. Close your eyes, go to sleep, little dog, for tomorrow.
That was KJZZ contributor Robert Pala. You can listen to a playlist of his favorite Christmas oldies on our Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.